is Ham Radio, KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, very good. No, I'm sure he's going to be very happy with all of that information. And it's amazing. He was listening to us almost 2 years now. And he, like I said, he's going to go for his tech. But it's just wonderful how his father is supporting this hobby for him. And he must really be doing well in school because he received a new scanner for doing so well in school. He just got that in the end of June. So I wish him a lot of luck with what's going on. Let me let it drop and I'll go on to the second question. Okay, Dick, this question is about a piece of waveguide. We've heard you speak about waveguide and that the fact that the waveguide has to be a minimum of half wavelength in dimension to be able to propagate the signal. Now, this question is, what if the frequency is doubled in a waveguide? Will it still propagate, and will the waveguide behave itself? I'll give us some tips on that for him.
The answer is yes and maybe. Waveguide has got a beautiful, extremely hard high-pass filter function to it. In other words, if I'm using a piece of waveguide in such a way that the horizontal dimension, the major dimension, is greater than a half wavelength at my frequency of operation, that signal goes down that waveguide and it's very happy. I'm inside of the recommended frequency range for that waveguide. In the case of WR90 waveguide, WR stands for waveguide rectangular 90. 90 means 0.9 inch wide. It's rated from 8 to 12 gigahertz, 8.4 to 12.4 to be exact. That's the middle of the frequency range. The actual waveguide itself goes all the way down to, I think, about 6.5 or 7 gigahertz is where it hits half wavelength. And if I found the exact frequency where it hits half wavelength, and in theory you and I could calculate that. I should know it, but I don't. Let's assume in my example it happens to be 6.0 gigs. And if I'm slowly sweeping down in frequency from 8 down toward 5 gigahertz, and as I pass through the magic region of 6 gigahertz, where in my example the waveguide is exactly half a wavelength there, if I'm plotting the signal that flows through the waveguide, I'm plotting amplitude versus frequency, I suddenly discover that as I hit that magic frequency, 6 gigahertz, and go a couple of megacycles below it, you'll be amazed how fast the signal falls off. A couple of megacycles below the cutoff frequency, the waveguide could easily go from a few dB per 100 feet to a few hundred dB per foot. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but it's an extremely hard cutoff, high-pass filter. As such, some of the most...
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
Once you recognize this particular crazy characteristic of waveguide, you can make an extremely high-performance set of filters that are classically called evanescent filters. Evanescent really means time domain. But in other words, by taking a piece of waveguide and putting posts inside of the waveguide and other apertures and whatever, I can set up a multi-stage filter which has a beautiful high-pass characteristic of the waveguide itself, and I'm putting these other things in the waveguide, like the so-called post could in some cases really be a screw in the broad wall of the guide going from the upper broad wall toward the lower broad wall, and by setting up those screws with the right spacing between them, and maybe some other posts in other locations, I can now make a multi-pole, very high-performance filter out of waveguide. As I go higher and higher in frequency, the waveguide has now got more and more than half wavelength of width. Eventually, it's got one and a half, two, three wavelengths of width. And as you go to those higher number of frequencies for a fixed piece of waveguide, you'll discover that the primary mode of propagation of the signal going down the guide, which is always zigzagging, it never goes straight down the center of the guide like your eyesight does. That's one of the crazy characteristics of waveguide. Let me drop. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, the angle it goes down there, the main signal goes down there, at an angle that is getting closer and closer to the great straight line of sight signal, the so-called axial direction. The bounce angle gets more and more shallow as you go to higher and higher frequencies. That's the main mode, the TE10 mode, the TE10 mode. And how many half wavelengths you've got in horizontal and how many half wavelengths you've got in the vertical, the major and maximum, the major and minor dimension of the waveguide, the way the signal goes down there is called a mode, and the TE10 mode is the primary mode of rectangular waveguides. Well, as you go to higher and higher frequencies, I can also find the TE01, the TE02, the TE21, the TE22. There's other kinds of modes. In other words, there's more than one method, more than one angle of bounce that Mother Nature will allow you to send that signal down the guide. So, will a higher frequency go down the guide? Absolutely. Will it go down the guide with lower and lower insertion loss for the main propagating mode? The answer is yes. And if you're real smart, you can set up various what's called mode killers. You can put filter-like networks in the waveguide which will allow only the main TE10 mode to go down the guide, and all other modes that are possible are suppressed. That's called overmoded guide. You can intentionally set up guide for higher frequencies, overmoded propagation, and you get a huge benefit. The insertion loss gets lower. Why is it getting lower? There's a smaller number of bounce per foot, so to speak, because you're bouncing at a more and more shallow angle, and each bounce has less and less loss, because as you recognize, let me drop. If I look at a storefront window at a grazing angle, at a very shallow angle, I'll realize that the storefront window is acting more and more as a mirror. And the radio wave propagating down a waveguide does that. As the angle of bounce becomes more and more shallow, the insertion loss of the bounce gets lower. So, overmoded waveguides, sometimes called tall guides, sometimes called overmoded guides, the higher frequencies will definitely go down there. And with mode killing, you can make sure...
Because you've now got
the different frequency regions of the 6-megacycle-wide television signal are going through peaks and valleys of amplitude versus frequency, you're now going to get a distorted picture. Some form of distortion is going to take place. The color is going to be shifted, or there's going to be ringing effects or whatever. So on a broadband system, multi-moding of the guide is undesirable. But a really smart guy can use the guide moding characteristic to his benefit. And let me go one step further. A piece of round coaxial cable, like a piece of a piece of 7/8-inch Andrew Heliax hardline. I think the maximum frequency we're allowed to use that is something like 3 gigahertz. The reason for that is that round piece of waveguide, a round piece of transmission line, with either a foam or air as the dielectric and a semiconductor with the right diameter so that's 50 ohm line, as you go higher and higher in frequency, the loss of the line goes up. That's not a given. As you go high enough in frequency, the outer diameter becomes a piece of round waveguide, which is almost a half wavelength wide. And now you've got the waveguide mode as well as the coaxial TEM mode going down the transmission line simultaneously. You use your Andrew Heliax 7/8-inch line at 10 gigahertz. There's at least 2 and maybe 3 different modes by which the signal can go down that guide. And depending on the length of it, down that transmission line, depending on the length of it, those individual signals will end up in phase or out of phase at the far end. If you're really smart on a narrowband system, you can use that to your advantage. If it's a broadband system, that system could give you quite a bit of grief, unless you've done other things to compensate for it. So the multimoding gives you a kind of a crazy differential time delay. It's called group delay distortion. Waveguide in general always has a small amount of group delay distortion. The higher frequency of a broadband signal, even if you're using the waveguide exactly where it's supposed to be used, a piece of WR90 rated for 8.4 to 12.4 gigs, and I'm using it in exactly that frequency range where only one dominant mode is capable of going down the guide, it still creates group delay distortion. Depending on the length of my guide and the bandwidth of my signal, the higher frequency components are arriving sooner than the lower frequency components of my signal, even within the rated frequency range of the guide. So if I've got a great big long piece of waveguide going up my broadcast tower, and I've got this beautiful broadband UHF television signal going down there, I've got to do some fancy compensating to make sure that I've got to do some fancy pre-distorting of the signal at the transmitter end to make sure that the signal that arrives at the antenna, the high-frequency components and the low-frequency components, all arrive at the same time. Otherwise, I'm transmitting a distorted signal, and my television audience out there might be very unhappy with me. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I think you see some of the things that can happen. So the answer is yes, but you got to be careful. But back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB, no tone. Okay. He has another quick question. He wants to know what is the use of a septum, whether it be horizontal or vertical, at the end of the waveguide. What is the purpose of that?
In the case of round waveguide, the good news about round waveguide is it's got lower loss than rectangular waveguide. Almost all the waveguide you can buy out of the catalog is rectangular. And depending on how much money you're willing to spend, you can get it silver plated, dry nitrogen filled, with pressurizing gaskets everywhere. You can go have a grand old time with rectangular guide. If I take the exact same outer dimension of a rectangular guide and replace it with a round piece of pipe, I have less insertion loss. That's the good news. The bad news is that the round pipe does not favor any particular polarization. If there's a small amount of runout of the pipe, in other words, to a very minor degree, the pipe is a slight ellipse where the height is a thousandth of an inch higher than the width of this round, so-called round piece of pipe. And I've gone into the Home Depot department with my calipers buying 3/4-inch round water pipe for my 10 gigahertz waveguide experiment, and I'm the guy that's measuring the runout of the pipes that are on the shelf, so to speak, and along comes the guy who runs the department and says, oh boy, another one of these precision engineers doing a precision plumbing job in his house. And I said, no, this is not plumbing. This is part of a microwave experiment for ham radio. He didn't understand what I'm talking about. So because of the run out of the pipe, I could launch a horizontally polarized signal into the round pipe, and at the other end, it might end up vertical. By putting in a flat piece of metal across the pipe, I can force, and it's called a septum, I can force a particular polarization. The E field is perfectly happy running perpendicular to the septum. It doesn't see the septum. If it's a horizontal septum, a vertically polarized signal will go through there like a charm, like nothing is there. A horizontally polarized signal will look at that horizontal piece of sheet metal, the septum, and it sees it as a perfect short circuit, and it won't go there. So,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
So by putting a liberal distribution of septums down my round piece of waveguide, particularly when I go around elbows in the corners, which will start launching other kinds of polarization, by putting septums in the right place, I can force the polarization to be one particular polarization on the pipe. So on round pipe, there's a definite need, in most cases, for septums. When a person puts septums in a rectangular piece of pipe, usually he's doing it for a filter function. If I have a septum that comes a quarter of the way in from the right-hand wall, narrow wall, and a quarter of the way in from the left-hand narrow wall, and I put these things periodically down my rectangular piece of waveguide, I'm now making multiple stages of a filter. And by having these partial septums, maybe a septum that goes all the way across with a hole in the center, or partial septums that come in from the sides or the top and bottom, and have other posts along the waveguide in between those septums, I now can set up an extremely high-performance waveguide filter when I'm doing that. So that's one of the other reasons. I could also be doing it as a kind of a mode killer. If I put septums or partial septums in the waveguide in various places, and I'm using the waveguide on an overdetermined frequency, I'm running at a higher frequency, shorter wavelength than that waveguide was designed for, by putting in those things in just the right places, I could kill the undesired mode, that really means way of bouncing, and have only the desired mode to survive my mode-killing circuitry. That's a third reason, and I guarantee there's a bunch of more reasons. So to a really fancy waveguide designer, a microwave engineer, you'd be amazed how many funny things you can do with waveguide, and you just started discussing some of them. I could even run a center conductor down the waveguide, which doesn't have to be in the center. I could put it off to one side. And I could be running the waveguide in the coaxial mode and the waveguide mode simultaneously on different frequencies. And I'm smart enough I can make that all work without them interfering with each other. Ain't that something, John? KC2WGV, K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2WGV, yes, that is amazing. There is so much to it. I do have one question, though. If you were to put those little septums on the narrow edge along the waveguide, what does that do to group delay? Any effect at all?
Don, good question. I might say I haven't got the slightest idea right now. Yes, I do. You're starting to move into what's called a kind of slow wave structure. Periodic perturbation of the kind that you're discussing, and there's a zillion ways of doing it, can make the wave go down the guide more slowly. Depending on how you put these periodic septum-like pieces of metal in the guide, depending on their orientation, how far they go, are they on the broad walls, the narrow walls, are they collinear, non-collinear, slanted, and whatever? There's a zillion ways you can design various kinds of perturbers by which you can generate a slow wave structure. You can generate a method of propagation down the guide where the signal propagates considerably slower than the speed of light. And if I was setting up a high-power Klystron amplifier or traveling wave tube-like amplifier, there's a definite reason why that would be a very desirable thing to do, because I want to slow down the signal that goes through my waveguide or helix-like function inside of my amplifying tube. I want to slow down that wave so that I can make its velocity of propagation down the tube, and the tube is a number of wavelengths long. I want that velocity of propagation to be equal to the velocity of propagation of the focused beam of electrons that are going down the center of the tube. And if I can make those two beams go down there at roughly the same speed, I can now couple energy from one to the other, and you and I call that gain. One of the traveling wave tubes, let me drop. One of those traveling wave tubes that I was using on the B-1B bomber program, which operated at roughly a KU band frequency, a really high power tube, each one of those tubes was $110,000 a piece, and I think the tube had something in the vicinity of 35 decibels of gain. 30 decibels of gain is 1,000 to 1. You put 1 milliwatt into the tube, and 1 watt comes out. You put 1 watt into the tube, and 1,000 watts comes out, so to speak, if the tube is rated for that. I'm not telling you what power level the tube is rated for, but it's a high power level. But these traveling wave tubes can have a ridiculous amount of gain, ridiculous amount of power output, ridiculous amount of bandwidth, when you design them correctly. So even though we think this is a solid state environment these days, we think everything that's really modern in electronics, particularly transmitting electronics, and we think that high power CMOS and I can't even think of the gallium nitride, gallium arsenide, all these fancy field effect transistors and cross field amplifiers, whatever, we think that solid state is the be all end all in the 21st century. Not necessarily when it comes to broadband high power transmitters. Many of your transmitters in television transmitting environment are tube type, vacuum tube devices. Many of the jamming transmitters and other kinds of transmitters that are used on military aircraft are vacuum tube amplifiers, traveling wave tubes and klystrons. So tubes are going to be with us in certain environments for a long time to come, because to try to build a solid state equivalent is extremely expensive and extremely vulnerable to a short circuit, so to speak. If a solid-state amplifier, a high-power transmitting solid-state amplifier, saw a high standing wave ratio because the antenna arced over for a short period of time, you could wipe out $100,000 worth of electronics in a few milliseconds, whereas a tube-type amplifier can tolerate that for a long period of time and have no damage to it. And the tube-type amplifier can have many times the bandwidth of the solid-state amplifier. So there's a number of places where solid-state is not the best way to do it. So I know that's off to one side, but that sort of answers your question. It's one of the methods by which you can build a slow-wave structure, to put a periodic, repeating, septum-like structure. And the actual shape of the thing that you put in that waveguide, there's a zillion ways you can shape it to get various kinds of performance. There's a whole art and science to doing that, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Who are we out there? Go ahead, Rich, and then turn it over to John. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Vic, I was just going to say I agree with you. You know, even in amateur radio, I know that, like, Tokyo High Power is putting out these solid-state amps. The thing is, they're very, very expensive. They use multiple transistors with combiners, and if one stage blows, you have a real problem. I mean, they're nice, but they're really not cost-effective for the average ham. That amplifier I built out of an AL-1500 that I sent you pictures of, that's one of my favorite tubes. Not a cheap tube, the 8877s, but as long as you protect them, because they got 15 watts of dissipation on the grid, as long as you protect them, they'll last for many, many years. And one of the best deals in amateur radio is still a glass tube, the 3-500. Today, a brand new pair of 3-500s is about $300 and something. They'll take all kinds of abuse, and they'll put out 1,500 watts. You can't beat that, Dick. Back to you, N2EO.
Yeah, that's a good point, Rich. And if you treat that tube correctly, if you use it in, within its ratings, the right amount of airflow and right amount of plate dissipation and so on, that tube could very easily give you 10, 15, 20 years of daily service. And with after 10, 15, or 20 years, it might be giving you 95% of the power output you had when it was brand new, if you treat the tube correctly. Solid state, by comparison, tends to be a lot more expensive and a lot more persnickety. The solid state amplifier, in many cases, cannot tolerate more than a 1.5 standing wave ratio without going into a self-protect mode and needing an antenna tuner after it. Whereas the tube-type amplifier, many of these tube-type amplifiers will tolerate a short circuit. They've got a nice tuning and loading control. The antenna tuner is built into the amplifier itself. It can tolerate an antenna that's, you know, 4-to-1 standing wave ratio is nothing for that antenna to do a match throughout most of the area of the Smith chart, if you know what I mean. So there are places where tubes are still very appropriate. And so vacuum tubes are going to be with us a long time to come. Hollow state amplifiers, if you know what I mean. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB, great description on that waveguide information. I thought of the group delay question after looking at how he was drawing his little diagrams here with these. He didn't know they were septums. He just called them blades. But interesting construct. Now, I do have a couple of questions left. You want to take a... One might be long, and I have a short one because it's getting late. What do you want to do?
We're probably going to take both of your questions, but if Jim is still on frequency, KD2BHY, there's some additional information from last week I'd like to give him. Let's see if Jim is still here. KD2BHY, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm still here, Dick.
Okay, this is designed for you, Jim. After a considerable set of discussions I had with Kent, my buddy in the Dallas area of Texas, Grand Prairie. I couldn't think of the name of his town. Grand Prairie, Texas, which is very close to Dallas. He had as an occupation for a period of time repairing and updating very high-performance metal detectors. And as such, he gave me some further information about metal detectors. But the main thing that I was going to tell you about is that the thing that many of the metal detectors, not all of them have, is the so-called sensing coil at the end of the wand. And that sensing coil is, in some cases, a 4, 5, 6-inch diameter coil that's built as a pancake, and it sits at right angles almost, or a slight angle, a tiltable angle, at the end of this great big long rod, a broomstick handle that you hold onto, and you wave this round pancake coil over the ground looking for pieces of metal as you're doing your beachcombing, so to speak. Let me drop. And one of the things that I didn't make clear is that every inductor is a so-called reactor. Reactor means that you cannot continuously pour power into it unless it's a transmitting type thing where it radiates some of the signal. If it was in a perfectly shielded box and it was a high-quality inductor, it absorbs some energy on the first half cycle and gives it back to you on the second half cycle. In the case of an inductor, it gives you back that power with a delay, a phase delay. In the case of a capacitor, it gives you back with a phase lead. But that's, and how can it do that? That's a little bit complicated. Take my word for it. However, in the case of an inductor, the energy that you put into it on the first half cycle, you could say it stores that energy for the first half cycle, and the energy that's stored, it gives back in the second half cycle. How did it store that? It stored it as a magnetic field. Every inductor stores energy by way of a magnetic field. If it's a toroid-type inductor where the magnetic field is thoroughly contained and internal, it's an internal magnetic field. If it's a pancake-shaped coil, that magnetic field is a whole bunch of lines outside of the area of that coil. That's the important part. So that inductor that's at the end of the wand of a certain kind of metal detector is setting up a magnetic field. That magnetic field goes some number of inches into space, and that magnetic field is being created and collapsing on each half cycle of the RF energy going into that coil. And now, if you've got a piece of metal in the magnetic field That's external to the coil. Let me drop. You now got to figure out, okay, what is that metal going to do to the magnetic field? If it's a ferrous piece of metal, iron-like metal, since magnetic field will flow through iron better than it does through air, the magnetic field starts gathering through that piece of iron, and the net result is the presence of the piece of iron gathers some of that magnetic field, and therefore the inductance of the coil increases when you put a piece of ferrous material there. So depending on how you set up the circuit, the increase in inductance is something that you sense. It shifts the frequency lower, the resonant frequency of the coil, and that shift of resonant frequency allows you to say, aha, there's a metal thing in front of my sensing coil. If it's a non-ferrous metal, like, say, for instance, a piece of brass, let me drop. The piece of brass, or piece of copper, or piece of aluminum, does not concentrate magnetic field. In fact, it is something that resists the change of magnetic field. The so-called eddy currents that are set up in a conducting material that is not ferrous, it resists the magnetic field. The magnetic field must flow around it. It cannot go through it. So the presence of a non-ferrous metal lowers the inductance of the coil. Us guys who used to do tuning up of IF cans, intermediate frequency cans, in a receiver, back in the old days, would use this fancy kind of a screwdriver, which as you turn the screwdriver, it would move a ferrite slug inside of the IF can, and the primary had a slug, and the secondary had a slug, and depending on which, you got access to the primary slug by going to the top of the coil, the open space on top of this IF can, and the hole in the bottom of the IF can, in the bottom of the chassis, you put your screwdriver there, your plastic screwdriver, and you would have access to the lower coil. And so by turning each one of those, you could tune the primary and secondary independently with that ferrite slug that was in the coil. That was the tuning slug. Stand by while I go to the other mode. Okay, so what I was starting to say is that what we used to be able to do with those things is we used to be able to pick up a fancy tuning tool which had a brass slug on one end and a ferrite slug on the other end. Which end of the tuning coil, which end of the screwdriver you plugged into the coil, you could either make the coil go higher in frequency by putting in the brass slug, or lower in frequency by putting in the iron slug. And so brass versus iron detection is one of the methods of operation of one of these metal detectors. So it's the external magnetic field of the sensing coil that's doing all of that operation. That's one of the things that I didn't make clear to you last week, and I thought you might appreciate hearing some of that, Jim. KD2BHY, I'll be able to hear you on the input. K2LAW on the tech pad. You got it, Jim.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. Yes.
As you can tell, Jim, there's a lot more to metal detectors. I'm now talking about the kind which shifts the frequency. That's the beat frequency oscillator type. There's a whole class of metal detectors that work by what's called RS. In other words, it transmits a signal and one set of coils. It's got another set of coils that are orthogonal, radio-wise orthogonal to it. In other words, you set up the second set of coils so that the signal, the radiated field from the first coil, is partially canceled as to what's picked up by the receiving set of coils, the other set of coils. And now the presence of a metallic object somewhere out in space of the first coil changes the coupling between those two sets of coils, and therefore that gets sensed by the electronics, and it allows you to know that a metallic object is there. That's one of the many kinds. And some of these metal detectors will only detect a piece of metal that's an inch away. Some of them can detect a piece of metal that's a foot away in air and maybe half a foot away in the ground. One of the things that Kent discovered is that when you go to a place where a lady used to have a wash line where she would hang the wash in order to dry, Quite often there are dimes and quarters and nickels in people's pockets that fall out of the pocket when the wash is hung on the line, and those coins would fall on the ground, and the lady doing the wash drying that way would not detect that. And so he would go to places where people used to have a clothesline, and he discovered that a coin tends to slowly sink into the ground a tenth of an inch per year, and depending on how many years ago it was that she was using that drying line, he would find that many inches below the ground, he could find dimes, quarters, nickels, and whatever, and sometimes other kinds of jewelry. So there's a whole art and science to doing metal detecting of coins under a wash line, coins near the rides of an amusement park.
Repeater, time out.
That signal was S9 at my location. Coins at an amusement park underneath the rides, you go to the right place and you're going to find coins, if you know what I mean, or other pieces of jewelry. Okay, John, why don't you go for the next step? Whether you choose the long one or the short one doesn't matter. Go to the next question you receive, John. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Okay. Tuning. The gentleman who's looking at this iTube notices it works, but it doesn't have a yoke on it. So maybe you could explain electrostatic deflection and the beam power system. So give him a quick description on that, and that shouldn't be too long. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, back in the early days of radio, they used to have this thing called the magic iTube. When you looked into it, it was about an inch in diameter. It gave you a circular green screen, and the green screen would have a V-shaped opening at the top near the 12 o'clock position, so that when a weak signal was present, you would have green in the lower half of the circle from the 9 o'clock position through the 6 o'clock position over to the 3 o'clock position. That part would be green. And as you operated the tuning dials of the radio and or in the early days, you also had a movable antenna. There was a great big coil on the back of the radio, and the radio was built in a wooden box. So you had a great big coil on the back of the radio, and you could change the position of that coil as a method of maximizing the signal. So the Magic Eye was a signal strength indicator. It was a poor man's equivalent of a meter movement, a so-called Dassendal movement. They must have considered Dassendal movements expensive, large, low in reliability, and whatever, so that many of the early radios did not have a signal strength meter. And they hadn't yet invented the barber pole technique of indicating signal strength. So this Magic Eye tube would change its amount of green illuminated area, and that the 9 o'clock to 3 o'clock area would slowly start closing down, so that maybe as you had a medium strength signal, it would go from the 10:30 position all the way around from 6 o'clock all the way around to the 1:30 position, so that around the 12 o'clock position, the dark position would start, that V would start closing down. And so you would now know how to tune the radio. As you tune the dial for frequency, you would make the best you could do to close up that gap and to tune the
repeater, timeout, cancel.
To tune the great big coil for the AM radio in the back of the radio to aim it in various directions. Again, you would be maximizing the amount of green area or squeezing down that V shape. And when you got the radio really tuned just right on a local strong signal, that green eye would close down continuous all the way, so that at 12 o'clock you'd see a little bit of a black line and the rest of it would all be nice and green. And no magnetic deflection coil is required. Internally, that tube was a kind of cathode ray tube. In other words, there was a filament and a cathode in the center that emitted a signal that would hit the phosphor that you would see that was giving you that green glow. And by techniques that I'm not completely familiar with, the presence of a DC voltage, there was a control voltage going into that tube, And so the signal strength indicator was really coming off the final envelope detector of the IF strip of the radio. And as the signal got stronger, the DC voltage got more positive. And as you put a more positive voltage on that control lead of the batch guide tube, it would, by electrostatic deflection inside, close down that eye. Now, exactly how they arranged that so it did that closing down, very similar to the complicated technique they used for a phase modulator tube. When you go to the website that is called WA2, I'm looking for the call letters right now, there it is, WA2XMN, Whiskey Alpha 2, X-ray Mike November. Don't go there with QRZ.com. It'll tell you nothing is there. You Google those call letters, Whiskey Alpha 2, X-ray Mike November, which is the experimental station of High Point, is it called? I can't think of the name of the town in New Jersey, where the great big Armstrong three-armed tower is located. Alpine, New Jersey. Well done. So Alpine, New Jersey, the broadcast enthusiasts, I think they're really ham radio operators, have gotten a special license by which they are allowed to periodically transmit at 42.8 megacycles FM wideband modulation, which is what Armstrong's original license was able to do. You go to that website by Googling WA2 X-ray Mike November, you'll find out that their beautiful transmitter, their classic transmitter, uses one of these phase modulator tubes. And you start going to the circuitry, you start going to the articles on it. It's a very fancy piece of electronics. So I haven't completely explained this magic eye tube, but I think I've given you what little bit I know. And maybe you or somebody else knows more about it, John. So drag your feet a little bit in case we have a magic eye tube expert on frequency. KC2 WGB, a little bit of delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WA2VDH with a comment.
WA2VDH. VDH. Okay, start off with your name, sir, and please tell us what you know on that subject or any other. You got it.
Okay, fine business, Dick. Name here is John. I just happened to grab my old Sylvania Lafayette radio in Jamaica years and years ago. But anyway, I looked up the 6U5. That's a 6 Uniform 5, which is one of these magic eye tubes. And the data on it shows that it has a triode section, and then coming off the plate of the triode section, there is another grid that goes controlling the electron stream to a target. And the information that they give on this is that by varying the voltage on the control grid, the triode section, between zero and about, looks like about minus 10 or minus 12 volts, they are able to get the shadow angle to vary from 0 to 90 degrees. I guess that's full open. And they mentioned that it is the direct replacement for the 6T5, 6H5, and 6G5. But you might be able to get some more information if you look at some of these tube info sites on the net.
U5. Okay, that undesired signal is S9 at my QTH. Mm-hmm. Nice and strong on the input. Very fine, John number two, on the 6U5 tube. And so I think I'm slowly catching on to what's going on here. As you put a more negative voltage on that control grid, the electron stream hitting the target gets more deflected and the eye opens up. In other words, the black region opens up. So I guess you've got a biased network being fed to your magic eye tube. As you tune your radio to the right station and you increase the signal strength of the reception, it's generating a more positive voltage, which overrides your negative bias. Therefore, as the voltage on that control grid of the 6U5 tube becomes less negative, more positive, so to speak, the eye closes down, is what I think takes place. Is that approximately it, John number two? WA2VDH, K2RIW. Thank you for the info.
Yeah, that's pretty much it, Dick. excuse me. That's pretty much it. It does have a triode section in there, which sort of acts as a control amplifier for the electron stream that's striking the target. So apparently it is the grid of that triode section that you put your AGC voltage on, which then varies the angle of illumination that you see in the front of the tube as a target. Go ahead.
Now, what we're discussing right now, the so-called 6U5 Magic Eye tube, and the kind of cathode-grade tube that's used on many of the modern-day, well, not so modern-day, oscilloscopes. But most of the oscilloscopes that we've ever used use electrostatic deflection. There's one set of plates that are vertical plates inside of the gun assembly of a cathode-grade tube, which gives you horizontal deflection by electrostatic means. By changing the voltage on those two vertical plates, you sweep the beam across the phosphor of the front of the tube horizontally. And somewhere nearby, there's another set of horizontal plates, one high and one low. As you sweep the voltage across those, you sweep the beam vertically. So your amplifier inside of your oscilloscope, the output of that amplifier connected to your oscilloscope probe as the input, that output goes to the vertical plates, and that gives you the up and down deflection of the sine wave you display on the screen. The sawtooth waveform, which is usually generated internally in the oscilloscope, goes to those vertical physical plates, which give you horizontal deflection, and that's what sweeps the beam from left to right. And so now by sweeping the beam in a sawtooth manner, left to right, where each box on the tube represents a millisecond of time, each horizontal centimeter is a millisecond of time, and each vertical centimeter represents one volt, depending on how you set the gain, you now can display voltage versus time and display beautiful sine waves and residue patterns and so on. So a classic vacuum tube type oscilloscope is also a tube using electrostatic deflection. You might ask the question, why in the world do oscilloscopes use electrostatic deflection, and why in the world do television sets primarily use magnetic deflection with deflection coils around the neck of the tube? Let me drop. And each has its advantages and disadvantages. The magnetic deflection of a cathode-grade tube for television display allows you to put a much smaller amount of energy into that magnetic structure. That magnetic yoke to structure also gives you another hidden advantage. By storing energy into that magnetic structure for the horizontal deflection, it's a sawtooth waveform, you now can store energy there, and on the so-called flyback of the sawtooth waveform, that stored magnetic energy comes back at you in a very short period of time. By rectifying that, that's how the circuitry develops the 25,000 volts that operates the cathode-ray tube. The horizontal deflection circuit, magnetic yoke, is really energy-storing device that's doing it for you. It's a dual purpose. But since the cathode-ray tube of a television set has a fixed rate of vertical and horizontal deflection, it is generating a raster scan across the screen. So everything is identical in time. So to do that magnetically gives you the hidden advantage of the dual-purpose circuit, and everything is exactly one frequency, and you can line things very carefully so that the horizontal deflection and the vertical deflection are doing the exact linearity that you want, and everything's hunky-dory. You don't do that for an oscilloscope because, let me drop, those horizontal coils and vertical coils on your cathode-ray tube for a television set have a finite amount of inductance. And so the inductive reactance of those coils changes radically as a function of frequency. When you and I go out and buy a cathode-ray tube type oscilloscope, in theory, there are some days in which I'm going to be displaying a waveform that might be very slow. It might be the DC voltage on a battery, and I want to watch that voltage very slowly descend and draw it across the screen as I set up the screen for a very slow horizontal deflection. And the next day, I might want to put a 100 megahertz signal into that oscilloscope and display it on the screen with the exact same amount of deflection. That's a huge requirement. To try to do that magnetically over that frequency range, the circuitry to do that, to compensate for the frequency response, would drive you crazy. Whereas with real electrostatic deflection plates inside the tube, each voltage on those plates gives you some number of millimeters of deflection, and within reason, that electron beam doesn't care if you do that as a DC, as a 1 hertz, as a 10 megahertz, or 100 megahertz rate of voltage change on those plates. In theory, you get pretty close to the exact same amount of deflection of the beam. And so the electrostatic plates used properly are very broadband in frequency response. Magnetically, it may take less energy to do it, but it's very frequency sensitive. And so your broadband oscilloscope would now be useful only over a very narrow frequency range if you decided to do it magnetically. So each has its advantages, magnetic deflection and electrostatic deflection. It's off to one side of what you asked, John, but maybe it helps. KC2, WGB, go on with the next one if you want to. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, WGB. Oh, yeah, very well said. And don't forget, the original television sets, they were 7-inch, and just before they got to the 10-inch side, were electrostatic deflection. They did not have yokes, and they used brute force to build the flyback voltages before they had that system. But also, let it be known that an oscilloscope, if you feed it the horizontal rate and the vertical rate, go into the Z-axis with the video modulation, you can actually watch television on your green screen oscilloscope. Not too many people realize that, but it's a lot of fun.
During the Apollo mission, the engineers at Airborne Instruments Laboratory didn't have a television set that they were allowed to bring in the front door. So some smart guy hooked up the particular receiver they were working on at the time that could tune to that local television frequency. So they had a receiver that would give them the Z-axis modulation, and somebody else hooked up various signal generators and whatever. And the bottom line is that we managed to get a green picture on a oscilloscope, a Tektronix oscilloscope in that laboratory. And my goodness, the word spread real fast that during the Apollo mission, during the landing of one of the astronauts, I forget which one it was, that we had this television set operating in the lab, and that lab became extremely popular. A gathering of guys around that tube, around that oscilloscope, the Tektronix oscilloscope, in between these two aisles of equipment, there were guys sitting on the benches, sitting on the upper shelves of the benches, guys piled up all over the place watching this screen. We were making jokes about the fact that when the screen wasn't aligned just right, somebody would grab the sync knob, the vertical gain knob, the linearity knob, or whatever, and so somebody in the background would say, "Everybody grab a knob." On top of that, we had such a popularity of guys that we were making jokes that every single photon coming off that screen, that phosphor screen of that oscilloscope, was falling on one set of eyes somewhere in that room. Not quite true. We were exaggerating. But was that a popular thing to do, and we did it. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Yeah, Dick, that brings memories. I've been doing that since the late 50s, early 60s, when I first got my first Tektronix. And it was a lot of fun and very interesting to do. Let me let it drop and I'll go on to the next one. KC2WGB. Okay, this is in reference to our discussion of the periscope antenna from last week. This gentleman has a question. He has four Yagis. Two have 3 dB gain and two have 6 dB gain. Okay, there are four of them. This is at 900 megahertz. He wants to transmit with one, the bottom of the tower, where there will be two antennas, one reciprocally placed looking at his transmitting antenna, and one vertical going up to the top of the tower. At the top of the tower, he's going to have another Yagi pointing to the one at the bottom. So there's your periscope. What do you think about it, and where would the best placement be for the gain of each antenna? Have you got the construct?
I sure do, John. Beautiful idea. Beautiful idea. He understands the concept, but Mother Nature is going to fight you on this one. Unfortunately, it's not quite a viable approach, and I'll show you why. A rear periscope antenna system consists of a high-gain dish at the bottom of the tower, aimed straight up in the air, and it's going to hit your 45-degree fly swatter at the top. If you could see the beam of the signal coming out of the dish, it would almost look like a flashlight beam. It would be very well collimated. If the dish was, let me pick a number, 3 feet in diameter at the base of the tower, when the signal got to the fly swatter, the signal might be a 5 foot diameter beam, if you know what I mean. And if you're using a 5 foot diameter fly swatter of the right shape and the right angle of aiming, a 45 degree angle to the ground, you could get a situation where, let me pick,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
That signal is 60 dB over 9 at my QTH. That guy's very local and mobile, moving. So you could easily get a situation where, with the parabolic dish type transmitting from the bottom of the tower to the top of the tower, I could get a situation where approximately 90% of the energy coming out of my dish is hitting the fly swatter. The fly swatter is larger in diameter, has a little bit more directivity, a little bit more narrow beam width, and so that system as a microwave waveguide, it's called beam waveguide, periscope antenna system, could have almost a decibel of gain on what finally gets transmitted by comparison to the signal strength of what comes out of the bottom dish. And so it's the equivalent of having a piece of waveguide going up the tower that instead of having a 5 dB of loss has got a dB of gain. Now, if I did it with Yagi antennas, and I have used three-element Yagi antennas on 915 megacycles, a good Yagi antenna, well-tuned at 900 megacycles with three elements, has very close to a 90-degree beam width in azimuth and elevation. It's not exactly symmetrical, but it's close. 90-degree beam width. Now you look at the geometry of this. That's assuming I've got a 50-foot high tower, and the signal that comes out of the bottom Yagi is being smeared over 90 degrees of azimuth and 90 degrees of elevation space. The Yagi at the top of the tower, one, two, three Yagis at the top of the tower, has an effective capture area of a couple of square feet. But that signal from the bottom Yagi is being smeared over 90 degrees, plus or minus 45 degrees in azimuth, plus or minus 45 degrees of elevation. So that the bottom line is that it will work, but it's going to have relatively low gain.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's going to have relatively low gain compared to using a real piece of transmission line, a coaxial cable going up the tower. The coaxial cable going up the tower at 900 megs, you choose the right kind of coax cable, I can have a couple of dB of loss. Whereas this Yagi approach, it will work, people will hear the signal, but when you really go and measure the gain, because the signal from the bottom Yagi is smearing its signal all over space, and only a few percent of the signal is being received by the upper Yagis, you can see immediately by conservation of energy, the whole system is going to have relatively low gain, John. It'll work, but when you really go and measure the gain, it's going to be a bit disappointing. Now, the next step is, could you build a big enough phased array on the ground to transmit the signal up as a beam, to capture the signal with a big enough phased array at the top of the tower? Absolutely, you could do that. But now you've got a lower diminishing returns. The total amount of hardware you would be putting at the base of the tower, the total amount of hardware you'd be putting at the top of the tower, in order to do it at VHF frequencies compared to a microwave frequency, where you can get directivity a lot more easily, the total amount of hardware required is quite extensive. And if you compare that to the price of the transmission line at VHF and low UHF frequencies, it is my guess right now at first that you're way ahead of the game to do it with a transmission line as opposed to beam waveguide. Beam waveguide, if you've got a big enough dish, starts becoming practical at frequencies like 2 gigahertz and above. And as you go to higher and higher frequencies, it gives you more and more performance. So at 10 gigahertz, oh boy, you can get tremendous performance out of a periscope antenna system. To do it with Yagis, which have much broader beamwidths, it's not so desirable. And you can see some of the equations that you look at in the books will lead you astray on this one. If you look at the practicality of beamwidths on each end, you'll be able to geometrically see what you're up against. I wonder if that makes some sense, John. KC2WGB? I don't know, that's a damn good idea. K2RIW.
Very good, Dick. I was hoping it was going to be usable because he's got approximately 200 meters to the tower from his barn that he's going to put this, he's going to move his shack into the barn. So that's a long run of cable. And the tower is only 60 feet. So his repeater is going to be at the top of the tower and a receiver up there. He already has power up there. So he was just wondering if he doesn't want to go through doing all of this, if it really is going to be a negative impact. So I thought it was a good idea, but I see the problem with beamwidth. He would be better off doing it with dishes and stepping that frequency up. If he could do it at 10 gig and then use a down converter up there, maybe he would be better off. But by the way, he cannot aim at the tower because of structures that are next to the barn that prevent him from reaching the tower. That's why he's going through all of this.
There's two different ways of looking at this, John. Getting the signal there for a transverter is one thing. To get the signal there that's being transmitted is another thing. Most periscope antenna systems are set up in such a way that the actual signal that you're transmitting is being emitted from the dish on the ground, the illuminating dish that's aimed up at the fly swatter. If I want to transmit 1 watt of power, I've got 1 watt of power coming out of the dish in the bottom, or 100 watts of power. I've got 100 watts of power coming out of the dish in the bottom in a real periscope system. If I'm running a transverter that has a separate power supply, and it's located at the top of the tower, and I've just got to get the signal there by whatever means, now that's easy, yes. To just get the signal there, maybe it's a single sideband signal that I've generated at, let me pick a number, 10 megacycles, and I transmit it from a rubber duck antenna at the shack, and the 10 megacycle signal is picked up by another rubber duck antenna. This is just an example. On the box behind the dish on the top of the tower, and then the converter circuitry takes that signal and puts it onto the 10-watt transmitter that's on the top of the tower. Yes, just getting the signal there, that's easy. But if it's really transmitting power that you want to send to the periscope antenna system, then only at microwave frequencies is it practical. What's really required is the right number of wavelengths of diameter of the emitting thing. The illuminating dish has to have the right number of wavelengths of diameter to have a narrow enough beamwidth so that it really is a collimated beam that goes up to the fly swatter. You see what's going on here, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW. That signal is now down to S6 at my location.
KC2WGB. All right, Dick. He's just transmitting signal, and there's a problem with getting the signal to the tower, but he can get at the bottom of the tower, so that was the idea of the whole thing with the four Yagis. He doesn't have a fly swatter system. He's going to have another antenna, which will be transmitting the repeater signal. But he just wanted to get the signal there. So, I mean, he could do some experiments and a little experimentation and see if it works without going into major installation. Just see if he can get the signal there. I would recommend he could try that, but it doesn't sound good from what you're saying.
Yeah, the real transmitting power, not so easy. That signal is 20 over 9 at my QTH. That man is in Suffolk County right now. Okay, yeah. I think you've gone through all of the mailbag for tonight. Is that true, John? It's up to you. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yes, I have, Dick. That's sufficient. And let's go to Paul. It's getting late. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Wow. I almost forgot Paul. Hey, Paul. Hope you're still awake. Well, Paul is a retired man these days. So maybe he's able, maybe he's got dispensation from his family to stay up late. WS2N, KQLAW, go ahead, Paul.
I stay up late when I was working. I don't want to miss the TechNet. But, Dick, yeah, just a couple of items that I wanted to just mention is the International Space Station. They did have three more people go up to the space station last week, and since we announced that, they've already docked. It takes them roughly two and a half days to launch from Kazakhstan on board a Soyuz to get to the International Space Station. And they docked with the Russian module, the RASVET, they call it. It's a docking module. The Russians have four docking modules on their side to handle all these different spacecraft from different countries that are coming up there. And that was the latest one that they had put in on STS-132 just a couple of years ago. I think it was about the third flight from the end, you know, from the last flight of the shuttle system. Let me drop it.